WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A team of scientists announced last week that they had synthesized a live poliovirus. It's the first time a live virus has been constructed from scratch. The experiment was financed by the Pentagon as part of its research on combating bioterrorism. Science journalist John Cohen has an article in the current edition of The Atlantic Monthly about designer bugs, genetically engineered viruses that could help humanity or be used as biological weapons. The virus Cohen has followed most closely is HIV. He's the author of a book on the search for an AIDS vaccine called Shots in the Dark. And last week, he attended the International AIDS Conference in Barcelona, which we'll talk about a little later. Let's start with a synthetically made poliovirus. It may help the Pentagon protect us against biowarfare, but it could also help inform the work of bioterrorists. I asked Cohen if the Pentagon funding of this experiment is controversial.
This is coming out of the DARPA group, which funds really high-risk experimental stuff. I don't think it's hugely controversial. I think most scientists thought that you could do this. It's not such a great shock that you can do it. Polio is really small. It's easier to do this with polio than just about any other virus that might hurt humans. And if you compare it to, let's say, smallpox, polio has about 7,000 components. Smallpox has about 200,000. It's much more complex to do this with a nasty bug like smallpox, and there are lots of people who doubt that given the technology that exists today that you could do it.
Now, in the current edition of The Atlantic magazine, you have an article about a mousepox experiment. Mousepox, I guess, is kind of like smallpox, but it only affects mice, not people. What was the goal of this experiment that you write about?
Originally, Australia has a horrible problem with rabbits and other introduced species. Australia is a big island that didn't have a lot of species that now exist there. And rabbits were brought in 1859 by a sportsman, essentially. And rabbits do what rabbits do, and they soon overtook the island and created what was called a gray blanket. And ever since the late 1800s, Australians have been trying to figure out how to take care of their rabbit problem. And this experiment initially set out to stop the production of new rabbits. It was biowarfare against rabbits.
And what did the scientists create?
Well, in 1950, the Australians tried to deal with their rabbit problem by releasing a virus that had never been released there, called myxoma virus. And I have to tell you this background because it explains what they ended up doing this time around.
Mm-hmm.
The myxoma virus was put into the environment there, and the first year it killed about 99% of the rabbits. It was a terrific way to kill rabbits. But over about 3 years' time, the virus and the rabbits started to figure out how to live together, and only about 95% of the rabbits died from the release of the virus. And then as more years passed, it became about lethal to about 50% of the rabbits. So myxoma wasn't that good of a virus to attack rabbits. So the scientists in this current experiment set out in 1988 to engineer myxoma to sterilize rabbits. Rather than to kill them, they just wanted to sterilize them. And that's the genesis of this experiment.
And then they tried to do the same with mice?
Right. Well, they tried to engineer myxoma virus to carry a gene from the egg of rabbits. So the thinking was is that they would teach the rabbits to attack their own eggs. But they didn't have the right genes to work with rabbits, but they did have them for mice and mouse pox. So it was sort of a parallel system that they could test the idea in of making a sterilizing vaccine, if you will. That's what they were up to. So they took mouse pox, which is a cousin of smallpox and is highly infectious in mice, and stitched in the egg protein into that background, into that vector is what mousepox is called. It's a Trojan horse that's going to then deliver this this egg protein. And it worked, but it didn't work that well.
Well, the larger point of your article in The Atlantic is that this is good news and this is bad news at the same time. How is this designer virus good news?
Well, it's kind of the great conundrum with all these designer bugs is, in this case, if Rats, for example, destroy about 20% of the world's crops. If we could better control rats, we could feed many millions of more people, people who are the poorest people on Earth, people who are some of the angriest people on Earth at countries that have a lot of money. So some people have argued that, look, by doing things like this, you actually reduce the likelihood of a terrorist attack by feeding more people.
And how is this bad news?
Well, the bad news is when they first started doing the experiment, they didn't have tremendous success in sterilizing mice, so they decided to introduce yet another gene to the mousepox virus. And this other gene they introduced was meant to tilt the immune system so that it would have even a stronger response against the eggs of the mice. And it surprisingly ended up killing the mice. The mousepox went into a strain of mice it usually didn't harm, and when it was engineered this way, they died. So then the scientists thought, well, let's give them the smallpox vaccine, which actually protects against mousepox because they're so closely related. And about 60% of the vaccinated mice again died. So it raised the specter that you could engineer a smallpox virus that would get around the smallpox vaccine. And that was terrifically frightening. And it is frightening that you could do such a thing because it's a great vaccine that has eradicated that virus from the Earth. It's the only virus that humans have ever wiped off the face of the Earth.
So with this designer mousepox and with the synthesis of the polio virus, what are some of the possibilities we're facing in terms of bioterrorism?
Well, I try to keep a really even keel when I think through this stuff and look at what does it really mean? What are we really facing in terms of danger? On the one hand, there are a few bugs that are nastier than natural smallpox. There are a few bugs that are nastier than natural poliovirus. It's pretty hard to design something that's going to be better. And in fact, if you do design something and put it out there, the odds are you're going to end up with a situation similar to the rabbits and myxoma virus. It will find a natural way to get along with humans that probably isn't as devastating to us as what already exists. So that's the rational, positive side of all this. The other side of it is there are really nasty, evil people in the world who spend their time thinking up horrible things to do to each other. And there are more ways to hurt people now more quickly than existed in the past because of these advances. So I think the real bottom line here is we have to be aware of what the potential attacks are and defend ourselves against them ahead of time. We could potentially make a vaccine that could deal with this smallpox bug that can now get around the existing vaccine. If indeed that's even true, this is a mouse experiment. I mean, who knows once you put this into smallpox virus what it will do.
You write that the Bush administration has removed from public access thousands of federal reports about germ warfare and that the Bush administration is starting to draft a new policy on information security. What are some of the things the administration has done and what are some of the things that are under consideration now?
There have been lots of studies of germ warfare that have been published and put on the web by the government, and those have now been taken off. They've also clamped down on what they will release through the Freedom of Information Act request. I recently had a response that was filled with blank pages to a pretty innocuous question about smallpox vaccine procurement. In addition to that, the Bush administration officials in a backroom meeting met with heads from the American Society of Microbiology, which publishes 10 journals, and asked them to at least consider withholding publication of some data. And one of their journals is indeed the journal that published the mousepox story, the Journal of Virology.
My guest is science journalist John Cohen. His article on designer viruses is in the current edition of the Atlantic Monthly. He was in Barcelona at the International AIDS Conference last week. We'll talk about the conference after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Cohen. John, in this month's Atlantic Magazine, you have your story on designer viruses. And you just got back from Barcelona, where you were reporting on the AIDS conference for Science Magazine. Is there a connection between AIDS and these designer viruses that may be used for good or may be used for biological warfare?
Yeah, there is. It's a strong one, too. HIV, essentially, is an emerging infectious disease that showed up in a big way in 1981 by introducing a designer bug into a population. You're effectively introducing an emerging infectious disease, very much in the way that HIV shocked people when it showed up. You could shock a population by introducing a new strange bug. Polio, by the way, showed up as a strange new bug as well in the 1890s.
Well, you just got back from Barcelona. What would you say was the general mood at the AIDS conference?
There are two worlds that exist there. One is the poor countries of the world and their needs, and the other is the rich countries. The overall thrust of the meeting was really directed at getting treatment and prevention to the poor countries of the world. The epidemic, in the words of Peter Piot, who's the head of UNAIDS, is really just beginning, and I think a lot of people have a hard time accepting that, but the new figures are astounding.
What are they?
Well, there are now 40 million HIV-infected people in the world. The projection is that by the year 2010, unless something is done in a comprehensive way, there will be 45 million new infections. I mean, it's chilling.
Yeah. What are some of the signs of optimism that you saw at the conference?
Well, there's a movement to get drugs to poor people, and it didn't exist 2 years ago. It really started 2 years ago, and the prices of drugs have plummeted. There are new drugs coming on the market for people in rich countries that will help deal with some of the severe limitations that exist to the existing drugs. There is basic research moving forward into new avenues that promise to deliver in 5 or 10 years. So there are positive things happening. Overall, though, the thrust of the meeting, the real gestalt and zeitgeist of it was the world has failed to really acknowledge what a horrible thing is happening in most of the world. 94% of the infected people in the world live in poor countries. And many people feel as though the leaders of the world are just standing by and watching.
What else struck you as being particularly important at this AIDS conference?
Well, 2 years ago in Durban, this incredible sea change occurred where people realized that the world could no longer ignore poor people, and the world had to start thinking seriously about getting drugs and prevention efforts everywhere. And a series of events happened after Durban, and something was created called the Global Fund to Treat AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis. That fund now has a few billion dollars in it. The goal is to have $10 billion for HIV and AIDS alone each year, and an additional $3 billion for TB and malaria. And much of the conference focused on that fund and how to build up its coffers. A lot of criticism was directed at the United States because the world really looks to the U.S. to see how much it will contribute. And so far, it has committed $500 million. Many of the people at the conference argued that it should be putting in $2.5 billion. And Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, in fact, there was a demonstration by activists there that would not allow him to speak. And he read his speech, but you couldn't hear a word of it. And much of their anger was directed at the U.S. contribution to the Global Fund, which they saw as paltry.
Is there speculation that the money would be higher were it not for the war on terrorism, as the war on terrorism seen as competing with money for AIDS prevention and treatment?
You know, I don't think so. I think that's used as a polemic by people who want more money. They argue, hey, look how much you're spending on this. Why don't you spend this much on that? The argument, and when you go to the International AIDS meeting, it's really like getting in the space shuttle and traveling to another planet. And you arrive in this place that has people from every nation with all different concerns who are watching this virus destroy the earth. I mean, that's really what's happening. And I know that sounds overly dramatic and apocalyptic, but you can't go to this planet and not see that. It's what's happening right now. So people pull out all sorts of rhetorical arguments to try to wake up the world to this reality, that this is the worst epidemic humans have faced. And people may be tired of hearing about it. They may be unconcerned because they're not connected to it. The reality is we are at the beginning of this. And so let's wake up.
Now, you mentioned that Tommy Thompson was jeered so loudly no one could even hear his address. Former President Clinton spoke at the AIDS conference. What kind of reception did he receive?
The audience loved Bill Clinton. He was his charismatic self, and he received a standing ovation. And I had a little bit of difficulty figuring out what his role here will be. He didn't really describe it in any detail. It's the first time he's come to an international AIDS conference. And the backroom discussions in the press room and the journalists, was, many of us were very confused because he elected not to speak with us. He did decide to speak with a small group of reporters from powerful publications together, but they didn't issue a pool report. There was no way for us to really know what happened. And for many of us who have covered this for a long time, it was a sort of a bizarre experience to have him show up and then not really address our questions, as most every other world leader does, about what they hope to contribute, where they fit in.
Did Nelson Mandela meet with the press?
Nelson Mandela did not, but he remains extremely accessible to the press. So it wasn't as much of an issue. It's not hard for journalists to reach Nelson Mandela. Traditionally, he goes for walks every day, and people can join him for his walks. And I think there was a clearer sense of what Nelson Mandela's role here is. Nelson Mandela spoke at the last conference in Durban, and it was one of the most powerful speeches I've ever seen anyone make. The whole room started singing his name and swaying, and it went on for minutes, and I think anyone who was there will never forget that. His symbolism is so very clear in a country that has 20% of the adults infected. And his leadership in the face of Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, who has questioned whether HIV even causes AIDS, needed no extra comment. But with Clinton, who's a newcomer to the arena here, I think there are a lot of questions about where he fits in.
Mm-hmm. You're the author of a book about the search for an AIDS vaccine. Are we any closer to a vaccine? Any new information about that that came out of the conference?
Nothing new came out at the conference that made me think we're any closer. There are more players involved now with deeper pockets than ever before. There's some positive momentum with a few big pharmaceuticals really trying to help solve the problem. The basic research news that came out of the conference regarding vaccines was very sobering and depressing and made the goal seem a little further away.
What was that?
Then again, well, one of the things that is curious about HIV is it's difficult to find people who become infected who can become infected again with another strain of HIV. That gives people hope that, hey, the immune system can learn to defeat the virus. But at the conference, there were three very solid examples of people who became infected with a second strain. It's called superinfection. And in one person, the researcher who made this presentation showed that the person had a terrifically strong immune response to his first virus and still could not defeat the second one. And that takes the shine off at least that immune component as being the way to go. Now, nothing's that simplistic. It's a system. There are all these components that fight the virus in the immunologic response. But there are always stars that rise to the top and become the favorites of the field. And this particular study really did take the shine off this one particular star, the star du jour.
So if the body can come down with one AIDS virus and not be immune to a different strain of the AIDS virus, that makes it more difficult for a vaccine to succeed against all viruses, AIDS viruses?
It does. It does, yeah, and there are lots of different strains of the virus circulating in the world. So the simplest thing would be a vaccine that protected you from the very strain you have. That would be the easiest thing to train the immune system to do. But what you need in the real world is a vaccine that protects you from absolutely anything you come across. And that's the dream, and this conference made it seem like a little bit more distant of a dream. The flip side of the coin is there are vaccines in human trials. One of them is in a full-blown efficacy trial, and we'll have information later this year as to whether it works. It might. Lots of people in the scientific community doubt it. I think the majority would say they have very low hopes that it will work. But who knows? You have to do the experiment.
My guest is science journalist John Cohen. He's a correspondent for Science Magazine and has an article in the current edition of The Atlantic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is science journalist John Cohen. He's been following the AIDS epidemic for years. He's the author of a book on the search for a vaccine called Shots in the Dark. Last week, he was at the International AIDS Conference in Barcelona. Are any of the new AIDS drugs running into problems of drug resistance?
Basically, all drugs that aim to stop viruses or bacteria run into problems of drug resistance. With HIV, it happens more quickly because the virus accumulates mutations so quickly and it replicates at such a rapid rate. So yes, basically every drug that exists is facing drug resistance problems, and there also is increasing evidence of people transmitting drug-resistant viruses to each other. A study that came out at the end of last year showed that 78% of people had some drug-resistant virus in their bodies. I mean, that's a staggering number of people. You can have some drug-resistant virus in you and still respond to other drugs, but over time you're going to accrue more and more resistance. That's the natural way of things. It's not going to go in the other direction.
Do you mean, was that a reference to 78% of the people with AIDS have some kind of resistant drug? Or
78% of the people with HIV infection,
right, okay,
in this study, in this very large study, had evidence of drug-resistant virus in their body, of at least resistance to one drug. There are now 16 drugs that have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. So you have a big quiver to choose from. But people are running out. And people are still dying from AIDS who are receiving the latest treatments. So some of that is certainly due to drug resistance.
The Global AIDS Fund is building a collection of money to be used for the prevention and the treatment of AIDS. But what are some of the issues behind how to actually use this money?
It's a dizzying question, and I think it was probably, in the conference, that was probably the most confusing question of all. Where does the Global Fund fit in with other efforts? And then how should countries receive the money? Countries have to ask the Global Fund for money and have to lay out their plans of how they would spend that money. This is all just getting off the ground, and there are some people who are now calling for a military-like operation that has a master plan of how to go about stopping the virus on the globe, as though we were one people. Let's pretend for a moment that we are all in this together. How should we best go about spending money? How much is really needed? How much should each country devote to this based on gross national product or some other formula? All these questions are defy easy answers, and they are ultimately what will decide who gets drugs when. And right now in sub-Saharan Africa, which has about 70% of the infections in the world, about 36,000 people are estimated to be receiving treatment. I mean, it's trivial. There are 6 million people in the world who need treatment now by the estimations of UNAIDS, and about 2% of them receive treatment. We're failing. I mean, you can't slice it any other way. It's a failure of the world. I mean, this virus takes apart societies. You have to see, I guess, firsthand what happens in countries that have 20 or 30% of the adults infected to just watch countries crumble.
Which hard hit?
There will be countries, I think, that may not exist in 5 or 10 years because of HIV. They may actually implode.
Which countries are you thinking of?
Well, Botswana has 39% of the adults infected. 39%. I mean, think about it. It's, you know, more than one in three. What happens to a country that has that much devastation? Now, maybe treatments will come in and prolong life enough in Botswana to make a big difference, but that's going to take a giant effort. And Botswana isn't alone. It has the highest prevalence of the virus, but there are other countries that once you get up, you know, into the range of 15, 20%, I mean, just take a moment and look around wherever you're sitting and count the people in the room and imagine a fifth of them gone within 10 years who are 15, 25, 30 years old. I've been to a lot of very hard-hit countries, and you know, frankly, I get very depressed by it, and it takes me a long time when I come home to sort of readjust myself.
Right.
And I'm not an activist. I'm a journalist, but you can't go into situations like this and not feel it. You'd have to have a heart of steel not to.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Terry.
John Cohen is a correspondent for Science Magazine. He has an article in the current edition of The Atlantic Monthly, and he's the author of a book about the search for an AIDS vaccine called Shots in the Dark.